ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
मन एव मनुष्यस्य पूर्वरूपाणि संसति भविष्यतश्च भद्रं ते तथैव न भविष्यतः. Translation: O King, all good fortune unto you. The mind is the cause of the living entities attaining a certain type of body in accordance with his association with material nature. According to one's mental composition, one can understand what the living entity was in his past life as well as what kind of body he will have in the future. Thus, the mind indicates the past and future bodies. Purport. I think this needs... Oops, this is a very controversial thing to say. This sentence, part of the purport needs editing a little bit. According to one's mental composition, one can understand what the living entity was in his past life. If we read that, we'll think that the one it referred to is the same person, but actually, according to one's mental composition, someone else can understand what the living entity is. So, if it's according to a person's mental composition, that would be that. I'll suggest it to Dravida. I'm going to send you. Sorry if it's considered profane to suggest editing changes in Prabhupada's books. But 4.29.66 edit. Purport: the mind is the index of information about one's past and future lives. If a man is a devotee of the Lord, he cultivated devotional service in his previous life. Similarly, if one's mind is criminal, he was criminal in his last life. In the same way, according to the mind, we can understand what will happen in a future life. In Bhagavad Gita, chapter 14, text 18, it is said, Urdvanga chanti sattvastha madhe tishthanti rajasaha jaghanya guna vritti stha adho gachanti tamasaha. Those situated in the mode of goodness gradually go upward to the higher planets. Those in the mode of passion live on the earthly planets. And those in the mode of ignorance go down to the hellish worlds. If a person is in the mode of goodness, his mental activities will promote him to a higher planetary system. Similarly, if he has a low mentality, his future life will be most abominable. The lives of the living entity in both the past and the future are indicated by the mental condition. Narada Muni is herein offering the king blessings of all good fortune so that the king will not desire anything or make plans for sense gratification. The king was engaged in fruitive ritualistic activities because he hoped to get a better life in the future. Narada Muni desired him to give up all mental concoctions. As explained before, all bodies in heavenly planets and hellish planets arrive from mental concoctions, and the sufferings and enjoyments of material life are simply on the mental platform. They take place on the chariot of the mind, Manoratha. It is therefore said, Yasyasti bhaktir bhagavatyakinchana sarvair gunais tatra samasite suraha harav abhaktasya kuto mahadguna manorathenasati dhavato bhihi. One who has unflinching devotion for the personality of Godhead has all the good qualities of the demigods. But one who is not a devotee of the Lord has only material qualifications that are of little value. This is because he is hovering on the mental platform and is certain to be attracted by the glaring material energy. Unless one becomes a devotee of the Lord or becomes fully Krishna conscious, he will certainly hover on the mental platform and be promoted and degraded in different types of bodies. All qualities that are considered good according to the material estimation actually have no value because these so-called good qualities will not save a person from the cycle of birth and death. The conclusion is that one should be without mental desire. Anyabhilashita shunyam jnana karmadhyana vritam. One should be fully free from material desires, philosophical speculation, and fruitive activity. The best course for a human being is to favorably accept the transcendental devotional service of the Lord. That is the highest perfection of human life. This important understanding is accepted as axiomatic by all members of the Krishna Conscious Movement. We wouldn't be in this movement if we didn't accept this, that according to the state of the mind, we have the present body and we get future bodies, so it may seem to be a given or something that it's just, we don't really need to discuss it that much because it's just accepted by us. However, we see in the very case of Prachina Barhisha that he also accepted this prior to being instructed by Narad Muni, because he was engaged. The king, Prachina Barhisha, he was engaged in pious activities meant for elevation to the heavenly planets. That means that he understood this principle already, that according to what we do in this life, we get future lives. Of course, Narad, he may not have heard the understanding of it explained as deeply as Narad Muni is explaining. And Narad Muni is not denying this principle, but he's telling the king that even though you have this knowledge, you're still a fool. Because simply to have knowledge of what is in the Western world called reincarnation, that doesn't necessarily make one spiritual at all. If one thinks that, okay, I have to get born again, what am I going to be next time? I'd like to be in heaven rather than in hell. Okay, let me do some activities that will take me to heaven. You're still a fool. We're not understanding that this whole chain of birth and death is simply miserable and not understand. Or one may understand this, one may come beyond the Karmakanda platform of performing activities for elevation in future births and come to the Jnana platform of accepting that life is miserable and still be a fool, a more learned fool. Because not accepting the ultimate principle that, well, we don't belong in this material world, and we don't belong in some state of nebulous disconnection from this material world either. We belong with Krishna in the spiritual world. Of course, the Buddhists, they have very strange explanations that there's no soul, but still there's reincarnation. So what gets reincarnated? Well, nothing really gets reincarnated because nothing is really there anyway. And there are all different kinds of theories. How do you explain? We have in Bhagavad Gita, Dehino Sminyata Dehe Komarang Yovanang Jarata Ta Dehantara Praptihi. It's usually one of the first three or four verses that devotees learn, if they learn verses. We hope everyone's learning some verses there. That Lord Krishna gives this analogy, that he explains that the body is always changing, but the person remains the same. So this shows that the person is separate from the body. And therefore, when all these changes are going on at every second, and over a period of time the changes are noticed to be changing from childhood to youth to old age and death, the death of the body is simply another change. But Lord Krishna says that the person never changed, and therefore death doesn't change the existence of the person. The person continues to exist. But to to explain that there's no actual soul. Some Buddhists, there are different schools of Buddhism, and some say that, well, there's no consciousness, there's no consistent stream of consciousness. So what's going on at every moment? The person or the non-person who is non-experiencing, the non-phenomena, all not around non-him, that non-person ceases to exist and is recreated, or not recreated, but again comes into existence. It's bizarre. It's difficult to even understand how they can make a philosophical argument for that and people can believe it or go along with it. The Bhagavat or the Upanishadic understanding is much more clear, but people want to avoid Krishna because they're fools and rascals. I didn't say so, Krishna said so. Namam duskrutino murha prapadyante naradhamaha maya pahrita jnana asurang bhavamashrita. For instance, that's just one of the verses in which Krishna points out he's not simply bad naming people without any reason, but he's just pointing out that if someone is such a damn idiot that they don't accept Krishna's supremacy, then what else can you call them? Just like if I say that we are all sitting here in Los Angeles and someone says, no, we're not. I say, well, we're in San Diego. And it's a free country and I have my own opinion and that's my opinion. So you can have your opinion, but you're a damn fool and an idiot. And a rascal, because, you know, if you say, now you have to pay the taxes or whatever, to local taxes, you say, no, it's San Diego, I'm not going to pay local taxes at Los Angeles. So then you become a rascal also. Foolishness and rascaldom are intimately interlinked. So it may seem that it's a very simple principle, and actually it's not that difficult to understand. But it becomes very difficult to understand because of not wanting to understand it, because of not wanting to surrender to Krishna. So what happens is that Maya, the illusory energy of Krishna, places people into such an illusion that they can't understand these very basic principles. I mean, what Srila Prabhupada taught was the very deep Vedic philosophy, but he presented it in a very simple way, because truth, the basic principles of reality are very simple. There is Krishna, who is the ultimate source of everything. There are the living beings who... There's Krishna and his energies. Actually, there's only Krishna. We are also Advaitavadis. We believe in what... it's not a question of belief, but we accept there is oneness. There is only one. That is Krishna. It's all right. I'm Suhas Prabhu, you don't have to walk out of the class. It's all right. I didn't become a Mayavadi. I'm just going to explain that. You know, you're not walking out of protest of the class. So, all right. I thought you were just going to get some rotten tomatoes out of the kitchen or something. So, everything is one. Did you hear that, Prabhus? Everything is one, okay? That one is Krishna. But that one, Krishna is everything, but he has his energies also, which are non-different from him in one sense. So there is Krishna and his energies. Krishna is supreme and his energies are subordinate to him. We are, all the living beings are his, basically part of his internal potency, but as the small sparks. That example is given in the Bhagavatam and Vishnu Purana of sparks in a fire. So we may become disconnected and lose our brilliance, but we remain, by nature, part and parcel of Krishna and subordinate to Krishna. So it's not in essence, although there are many complex details, it's not a very difficult thing to understand. But it becomes difficult to understand when we don't want to understand. And Maya, which is also an energy of Krishna, provides the understanding by which we don't understand, or the conception by which we don't understand. So the present body that we have and the future bodies that we may be placed into, that is based on the conceptions which we form. What is the mind? It's a process. The mind has various functions. It's a processing house of sankalpa vikalpa, accepting. Yes, I accept this. I like this. Vikalpa, I don't like this. This is good for me. That's not good. I accept it. Vikalpa, it's not in my self-interest. It's not good for me. But all this activity of sankalpa vikalpa, the activity of the mind accepting, yes, I will vote for such and such because he will serve my self-interest, he will serve my interest, but or the interest of the nation, because I am an American and we want America to flourish, and this person will make it flourish better, and the other one is completely useless. It depends on which side you are. You think that one is great and the other is completely useless. That's the other one is, if he comes in, it's a total disaster. Of course, whoever comes in, it's a total disaster, but that's a certain point of view. So we have various conceptions. I like to eat chocolate. There you are, I said it right on the Vyasa sign in LA. I like to eat chocolate, therefore I shall eat it. But wait a minute, I won't eat it because Prabhupada didn't want us to eat it. Okay, I won't eat it. So this way, the mind is it's a processing house. I like it, but wait a minute, that's not good. I like to drink beer, but wait a minute, that's not good. I'll get drunk and then can't be a sannyasi anymore. Or even someone who's going to drive a car who's not a devotee, you think, well, I shouldn't drink beer because I might get caught or I might crash the car. So it's a processing house with the intelligence. What should be accepted and what should be rejected? But it's all based on the particular outlook or worldview that someone has. Prachina Barihishat, he had the worldview that, or he had the outlook or the understanding of life that I should perform sacrifices, this is a pious activity, as a result I will be happy in this life, my citizens will be pleased, I will be praised as a pious king, and my kingdom will run on nicely, and after I die, people will, in future, people will compose songs about me and tell what a good king I was. Then I'll go to the heaven, the planets, and enjoy there. And it's great. Everything's good. Good in this life and good in the next life. So, great. That's what I'm doing. This is the purpose of my life. And Narada Muni comes along and says, actually, sir, you are simply a damn fool. This is not the goal of life. You think you're being pious, but actually you're committing sinful activities by unnecessary killing of animals. And even if you are spotlessly pious, the very nature of piety in this material world is ultimately impious anyway, because it's all avoidance of Krishna. So Narad Muni changed, or he fine-tuned his understanding of birth and death by pointing Prachina Barihishat to his ultimate good, the ultimate reality. But the point here in this verse is that the condition of our mind that shapes our future births or our future. Even if someone doesn't believe in reincarnation or they don't accept this principle, this principle can be understood even in this life. That's why there are so many books on self-improvement. What are these books on self-improvement? There's courses, seminars. The whole idea is to adjust the condition of the mind. Instead, where one person sees difficulty, another sees an opportunity. What for one person is defeat, it's hopeless. For another, it's a challenge. So it's changing people's outlook to what they call a positive outlook. And of course, without knowledge of birth and death and without knowledge of Krishna, it's all useless, because what's the use ultimately of even if you have a positive outlook, if you're positive about the wrong thing, then that's actually less intelligent about than being negative. If we're positive about being successful in this mature world, it's actually better to be, it's more realistic to be negative, because there is nothing good in this material world without Krishna consciousness. So to have a positive outlook may seem to be better, but you're just becoming better in the wrong way. So is it better to be negative about the wrong thing, or to be positive about the wrong thing? Positivity, having a positive outlook, isn't a quality in and of itself. I mean, to use an extreme example, the German people were very positive that Hitler's guidance was uplifting them, and they were all very determined and confident that invading all these countries and killing all the Jews and Poles and everyone else and Czechs, that was good policy. And they were confident, and they were very positive, and they were determined, and they had good team spirit, and they had everything good, except their idea was demoniac. And the result was a disaster to humankind. So, really, although the discussion here is about the nature of the mind, that's true, it's true for every living being, that we get body after body after body according to the condition of our mind. This is a basic principle. But then the next question is, the next thing should be then, well, what should we be desiring? Or what? It's not just a matter of going from body to body to body, but of understanding that this whole cycle of birth and death is miserable. And that therefore one should train the mind, or accept the training, so that the mind is attached to that which is actually for one's own actual welfare. Here we find Narad Muni is blessing the king. Bhadram te, good fortune unto you. So Narad Muni, by saying good fortune unto you, he wasn't meaning that, well, have, you know, good luck with your sacrifices. He was rather instructing Narad Muni he was instructing Maharaj Prachina Bharati that you have to make a radical change in your life. You think that you're on a good course, and it seems like you're on a good course, and everyone around you says that you're on a good course, but it's not actually beneficial for you. So just understand this. Now this is very apt advice, not only in the modern world, but in the material world, in all times and all places and all circumstances. It's particularly apt for the grossly misdirected civilization, of which Los Angeles is maybe the epitome. Of course, there are many big sinful cities all over the world, but Los Angeles has got it all. It's got wealth. It's the only city in the world with Hollywood, although India has a poor imitation in Bollywood. I don't know whether it's poor. I mean, I'm not a connoisseur of films. But anyway, it has the climate, for that it has the millionaires and billionaires and the freeways and all the misery and suffering that goes with it. So this knowledge is most apt for a totally misguided civilization. It's apt for Prachinabhar. He wasn't totally misguided. He was within the Vedic culture. He had some idea, he had the basic structure, the basic knowledge of what to do, but he didn't know why to do it. He had the idea already that we are going from body to body to body, and therefore we should follow the Vedic directions. But he didn't understand the real Vedic purpose, But still he was a lot closer to receiving this knowledge. And we find up to the present day that persons in Vedic culture, who are nowadays called Hindus, that in general they are more willing recipients of the knowledge of the Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya than are non-Hindus. So this cultural background was very useful. Of course, Srila Prabhupada, as a representative of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, his mission was not simply to save the Hindus, and practically to save the Hindus, which is, again, it's not very meaningful in itself, because the jiva is by nature not a Hindu or a non-Hindu. But to save the whole of human society, it's required to preach throughout the whole of human society. And although the Hindus in general are more willing recipients of this knowledge, they became more willing largely because they saw that Westerners were taking it up. Otherwise, Prabhupada was trying to preach in India, and there wasn't much interest, because the propaganda at that time was that Indians had too much religion, and it's time to throw out the religion and build factories. That was the propaganda of Pandit Nehru and others. But particularly that was his outlook. So there's no doubt that people who don't have this basic cultural knowledge and background, it's more difficult to bring them into Krishna consciousness, but that's a great challenge to do that. And the truth of changing bodies and surrendering to Krishna, that's true for everyone, whether they have that cultural background or not. And everyone can accept that. Although it's, in general, it may be more difficult for persons of a non-Hindu background to do so. So how to present this knowledge in a manner that people with little or no background of it will accept? Well, that is the mission of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. How to present this knowledge? Really, it's really kindergarten stuff, as all of you know, and it's very apparent to me, because I live mostly in India, and definitely we can, although people are very much bewildered and ignorant, but in India also, but here it's the disease of ignorance, or the diseases caused by ignorance are definitely more manifest and gross in the Western world. But Srila Prabhupada showed that it is certainly possible to convince Western people, or even scientists, just like Sadaputta Prabhu, scientist. He was convinced of Krishna consciousness. He became a devotee. He was actually convinced, even before meeting Srila Prabhupada, that Darwinian evolutionary theory is bogus. As a scientist, he was convinced. And we find that nowadays more and more people, scientists, are convinced that it's bogus. And thus some scientist has come up with a theory, the God gene, that this belief in God is due to some rogue gene that has been passed down. It's laughable, isn't it? I mean, it's clutching at straws. It's such a useless argument that even I saw on Jayadvaita Swami's blog, he featured a 2.5 minute podcast by John Cleese, who some of you may know the name of. I remember from my childhood, he's still around, who was spoofing this stupid God gene theory, taking the role of a scientist. And it's great, actually, that they've come out with this theory of the God gene, because it shows ultimately what they have to. For so many years they were just talking all kinds of bluff and people believed it, but now they have to up the level of their bluff to such a level that anyone who's got Even anyone who's not a scientist but just somewhat clear thinking can see through it. It's just a bunch of it's dogmatic faith in no godness. You might as well say that there's a no god gene for that matter. Why don't people believe in God? Because they got some gene got messed up in some monkey who made it with another monkey, and here we are today. With so it's actually a great opportunity, because it appears that the way science is going, that the evolutionary theory is going to get thrown out. It's on the way out. But then the obvious alternative is there must be a God. But then on the other hand, if the God of the Bible or the God of the Quran, it's why did the idea of God get thrown out? Because the idea of God as propagated in the Western world is so insufficient and childish, and the theology they have is so stupid, sorry to say. But, I think why the whole of human suffering is caused because way back someone ate an apple. I mean, it's really very, very poor theology. And then, never mind, God came along and they killed him. They killed God and he was dead for 3 days. And now everything's okay. But if you don't believe in him, you go to hell forever because he loves you. I mean, it's really very poor theology. So, if you're caught on one hand between these... there's stupid science on one side and stupid religion on the other, and where do you go? And then and then people become a Buddhist, which is stupidity cubed or something. It's raised to the power of 10 million or something. It's really just everything's nothing. But wait a minute, these books, they do present clear knowledge, which is understandable, reasonably presented. It appeals to the intelligence, and it makes sense. And people, it requires that our devotees, they become well learned in this philosophy and how to present it, because those people who are not totally sucked into the sense gratificatory way of life, and there are some, and there will be more, as the sense gratificatory way of life crumbles all around us, which it appears that it's starting to do. The meltdown is on. It's already a great time for preaching, and it can only get better. So it requires that devotees distribute lots of these books. Is that right? I think I'm in the right place to say this here. I won't get a the 2-3 people who might be in the class staring blankly at me, looking, what's that? What's he talking about? I mean, here, at least, the parampara has never stopped. It's not a case of the broken parampara that has to be restored. There's the book distribution here. Distribution of Srila Prabhupada's books never stopped. Congratulations to all of you great souls for that, and all the new great souls who are coming in and doing that. And also presenting this through various fora. Last night I was called to a university program, and the subject was the yoga of mind control. So personally, I find it doesn't lead us very clearly into Krishna consciousness, but it was, and actually most of the people who were attending were Indians, and I could have spoken with them, Indian students, and I could have spoken more directly about Krishna consciousness with them. But there were a few of non-Hindu background also, who they knew it was a Hare Krishna program, and they were interested to see what it was. It doesn't mean that they're ready to shave up or immediately, but they may have seen our books, or they know about us, and definitely anyone who reads these books, and there are a lot of people out there reading these books, despite propaganda that there aren't. At least it's my experience. I mean, many people have read the books. They can, although they may not understand it very clearly, because it's a very deep subject, but they can understand that there is ancient knowledge of the most important issues, or the actually important issues, are very at a level which is not discussed anywhere by anyone else in society. Even the so-called swamis and gurus that come from India, they're quite superfluous. So many people are appreciating that these books, they have a knowledge at a level that we don't get in the school system, we don't get from our so-called religion. They can begin to appreciate this. And if we go on presenting these books and the knowledge within them, I'm sure that this movement, it's, you know, we shouldn't think that it's all over, or it hasn't started yet, practically. I mean, the best is yet to come. If we remain faithful to these books, that's the key. Because Maya is always pulling us away and saying, well, you know, that's not really true, and that's just some fanaticism, and that was okay in 1966, but now it's 2008 and that it doesn't apply anymore. You know, from the time of Vyasa up to 1977, it was valid, but things have changed since then. So if we just stick to the principle of everything that Prabhupada has given us, and intelligently present that, both in our practice and precept, both. We have to live it, and we have to present it. Certainly, there is very great future for the Krishna conscious movement by pointing out to people how they can be relieved from all their suffering. It's what the Buddhists say is that suffering is simply a mental construct. Well, that's true, but the positive mental construct is that of eternal bliss in the service of Krishna, whereas the Buddhists say that it's just not real. It just doesn't exist. There is no suffering. There is no anything. So, like this, the different doctrines, they may appeal. Buddhism may appeal because it has some elements of truth in it, although they mess it up on it. They mess up important areas of understanding. And then we have theism. I mean, I'm not totally against Christianity, it is theistic, which is better than Buddhism in that sense, but then philosophically they're very weak and they don't understand how they don't have any sambandha gyan, they don't know who God is or who the soul is or what our relationship is or how we're in this material world. It's practically just a belief. That's why they say in the dictionary, it says religion is a kind of faith, but Prabhupada presented, no, it's a science. So all the various bits and pieces of truth which are there in the great thought systems of the world, they're all clearly presented and brought together without all the different misconceptions which come from speculative philosophy. So this is the treasure that we have. This is the actual knowledge which can deliver each person from their own mental ramblings and deliver the whole of the world. And I'll finish there. If anyone has any questions or comments, please make them now. All right, please. I saw that hand first. Wait for the microphone. Okay. I'd like to say more, but I'm trying to finish.
It's all over the world.
It's all over the world. Okay. Yeah, all right. Do you have people can call in from all over the world to ask questions? Oh, I see. It'd be nice if you could have some system by Skype or something. They could call in. That would be exciting, wouldn't it? How about that? Who's your resident computer genius? Sorry? Oh, you get it right there, right now. Oh, okay, fine. Yeah, all right. Oh, all right. The mic went to you. All right. That's fate. I'd asked you.
In Srimad Bhagavatam, this is saying, when and where Buddha appeared, incarnation of Buddha. And if you have experience when you preach the Buddhist, you point out
The Buddhists. You mean the Buddhists in America? Yeah. There are not that many Buddhists in India. Yeah. Yeah. So? How do they respond to that? Well, they don't... I was in a Buddhist area for quite some time in Thailand, and they just don't accept it, that's all. They don't accept that there's God, that there's any supreme being, or that Buddha's a supreme being. There are different schools of Buddhism. Apparently in Sri Lanka, which I visited briefly for the first time late last year, they're in Thailand and in Sri Lanka, they're both Theravada Buddhists, which means they don't accept that there's any God or there's any existence or any, and it's the most voidistic branch of the two main branches. But apparently in Sri Lanka, if they accept, I don't know that much about it, so I can't answer you fully, but they accept the identity of Buddha with Vishnu. They may not have a very clear idea who Vishnu is or how Buddha is Vishnu, but they haven't heard of Krishna. But if you tell the Sri Lankan, the Sinhalese people who are Buddhists, that they ask, well, what is this? What are you doing? If you say that we are followers of Vishnu, they'll say, oh, that's very nice. So, but of course, the average person doesn't have a very deep understanding of any of these things, the philosophical issues. I don't know that much. I haven't made that much study of Buddhism. Sorry, even though I was talking maybe as if I did, but I don't know that much about the culture and the traditions. And it's one thing is that there are many different schools, and it's as you can expect from a speculative philosophy, there will be many, many schools, because it's just on the mental platform. And one philosopher thinks differently to another. And in dealing with issues like this, and then what is the nature of everything that we see all around us when everything ultimately has no existence? Or what does it mean that there is non-existence? There is no existence, and they're arguing with each other over the nature of non-existence. How is non-existent not real? And then someone says, well, it's not real like this, and someone says, no, it's not real like that. It seems like a very absurd argument, doesn't it? And then ultimately it comes to absurdity, the sound of two hands, one hand clapping. That was how Buddhism was introduced popular Buddhism was introduced to the West by Alan Watts, who in America, at least it seems, in the recent or the last generation, and he popularized this particular koan, that the meditation on the sound of one hand clapping, and really it does symbolize the absurdity that we're led into if we try to deny the reality of everything. That's what it comes down to. They discuss the nature of perception, but then the question of, well, why do we perceive anything? They don't deal with that at all. So it's kind of like half a philosophy or something. Yeah, all right. Well, now, sorry, Amir Vilas Maharaj has his hand up there, so. Of course, it is on the internet. We may, you know, the speaker tomorrow may be bombarded by Buddhists, so, okay. What do you have to say? But by the way, those who know do not speak, so all you Buddhists shouldn't speak. According to your own philosophy. Yeah, it's a bit of a mystery, actually. It seems that there are different the nature of Buddha avatar is, it requires more research from our Vaishnav side also. Because the Gautam Buddha and the Shakya Singh and all this, it's not clear. According to one book by Bhakti Pragyan Keshav Maharaj, the Buddha of Buddhism is not the Buddha of the Bhagavatam. But from what I've seen of the writings of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati and certainly of our Srila Prabhupada, he either conflated the two or accepted the two as being the same. But there are some questions there, because one is said to have been born in Gaya, that's said in Bhagavatam, Kikateshu. He will be born, Kikateshu Bhavishyati, he will be born in Kikata, which corresponds to the modern area that we call Bihar. And then, but the Buddha of Buddhism is said to have been born in Lumpini, which is in now in Nepal, which is not so far away. So there's some question there over the identity of the Bhagavatam, the Buddha mentioned in Bhagavatam, and there's more than one Buddha mentioned in Bhagavatam also, and the Buddha of modern Buddhism. Requires more research. We require a research institute to research many different issues to resolve these so that we can satisfactorily present them to the devotees and others.
As we know, Shankaracharya, he appeared in the 6th century?
Well, 8th century is what is standardly said, as far as I know, but that's also, it's not clear. Needs more research. There are different opinions about that.
It is explaining that Shankaracharya came to drive away Buddhism
that's what Prabhupada said, yeah.
Buddha, so it's clear, Buddha appeared in the Nirvana.
Yeah.
So it's clear, according to Bhagavatam.
Is what clear?
Meaning that Buddha himself, according to Buddha's experience, the previous Kali Yuga, that is explained in Bhagavatam, right?
Yeah, at least two Buddhas, because there was one in a previous age that's mentioned in the second canto also.
So this Buddha appeared.
Yeah.
Prior to Shankaracharya.
Prior to Shankaracharya.
Yeah. So it's very clear what I wanted to say that. For the Lord appeared, not as a six incarnations, Purusha, Avatara.
Six kinds of avatars, yeah.
So, empowered incarnation that they have got Buddha.
Hmm.
So, every Lord Himself says in Bhagavad Gita, I appear in every millennium.
Hmm.
Yada, 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 belonging to God. So every religion has a perfect in the sense, according to the time and circumstances, appear. Prabhupada says that when Krishna told Arjuna, give up all kinds of religion, sarva dharma paritya mami kamsharam. A real religion means surrender to the Supreme Personality of God. What I wanted to say that just now this Prabhupada asking about Buddha, I don't know what he was. We were also explaining. As far now, Prabhupada said that there is no, especially in Kali Yuga, there is no Krishna like a people. It's only the name Buddhism, Christianism, Jainism, all isms. Nothing more, one conflict.
There is no, for when the Lord appears, the religion is perfectly followed. But after some time, now like a, let us say, even Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared finally 22 years ago. But that is not being followed perfectly. Again re-established by Srila Prabhupada. Vaishnava Dharma.
What's the point, Maharaj? What's the point you're getting at there?
Commenting, trying to explain that the dharma, the real dharma is surrendered to Krishna.
Right, that's true.
So nowadays, when you talk about Buddha, as you are explaining about Buddha, so where will you find a pilot? There's no real sense. The books, what I try to say, it's no use of referring to these people because they are not following really Buddha. Buddha taught Ahimsa Parama Dharma, but now so-called Buddhists, they eat meat, they kill animals. Same thing Prabhupada said, Christians, Jesus said, thou shalt not kill. So you really don't find real, Buddhist, real Christian, real Hindu. There's only one religion that is.